the festival and your work is clearly all about being fiercely independent. And so can you tell us why that's important to you?
It has so much to do with people having a voice and being able to speak their mind and the truth and speak to justice, speak to power, and be independent. I think that's what connects all my films, actually. So I was glad you asked that question. I really do think that my films really are about people feeling empowered and having a voice. And I think that's what independent film is very often about, because we never know what's going to happen with our films. We never know how many people will see them. We'll never know. They're not backed by major studios. So if we don't have something to say, we're probably not going to make it. And I would encourage people who feel that they have something to say to just get out there and make those movies. And festivals like the Woodstock Film Festival, I am sure they're going to be there to support you. I know you can't show every film that's been made, but they will be looking for films that have that voice.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. I'm your host, Katie Mejia. The Woodstock Film Festival is a haven for networking with high-caliber industry members, voting members of the Academy, filmmakers, musicians, and fiercely independent artists. The 24th annual festival takes place September 27th to October 1st. Be sure to submit your film by the early deadline and don't wait till the last minute. I am honored to be here today with Nancy Bursky, founder of Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, director, producer, writer of the documentary film Desperate Souls, Dark City, and the Legend of Midnight Cowboy. She's also director, writer, producer of A Crime on the Bayou, The Rape of Recy Taylor, and also The Loving Story, which came out in 2011. She's also producer of the narrative film Loving, which was 2015, and special advisor to Summer of Soul, the Academy Award-winning film, for Best Documentary. Welcome to the podcast, Nancy.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm honored. So I just want to get started with how we kind of kick off this podcast. Tell us a little bit about your history with the Woodstock Film Festival.
I believe we showed The Rape of Recy Taylor here. Yeah, thank you for nodding your head. I sometimes confuse festival events and attendees, but I enjoyed it so much.
Because you yourself founded a film festival. So why are festivals important?
Oh my, there's so many reasons. It's the intimacy of the festival. It's the ability to have an interaction with the filmmaker. It's very important to have an interaction with with an audience. So much of our films, so many times our films are streamed or on, if we're lucky enough to be on a cable or streaming, and we will have maybe a small theatrical release. So for a documentary especially, it's important to be at a film festival like this where you can feel the audience and you can understand. I end up understanding my film better when I see it with an audience and when I have a talk back with the audience. So that's one reason. And then there's so many others. I mean, one of the beautiful things about Woodstock is that there is this intimacy that people that come to this festival have been coming for years. They love talking about films. There's a wonderful interchange between among filmmakers as well as audience. It's a magical time.
I think, you know, a lot of film festivals are either really, they're really like, you know, they have that vibe or they're just massive. So it's kind of rare to find the in between and, you know, to have a good size audience, but then having that intimacy. So, you know, right. The Woodstock Film Festival is kind of one of those rare birds. And so this weekend, May 13th, we are going to screen your latest documentary film, Desperate Souls, Dark City, and the Legend of Midnight Cowboy, which you also wrote, directed, and produced. You mentioned that the inspiration came from the book about the making of the classic 1969 film, Midnight Cowboy. Can you just tell us how this project came about?
Well, first of all, let me mention that I'm honored to take those credits, but you never make these films by yourself. And I will be traveling with Susan Margolin, one of the other producers. We have Simon Kilmurry, who unfortunately can't attend, but he is one of our producers. So that teamwork is so vital to making these films. The writing takes place in the edits, so I have to honor Anthony Rapoli, who's my editor. He and I work together every day when we're creating these movies. So, but thank you very much. Let me go back to your question. I am fascinated by art and what makes certain art last. And so I often look for a subject that reflects on the culture and why a film like Midnight Cowboy still resonates today. And in a nutshell, that's really why I made this movie, because I wanted to interrogate that. Why does Midnight Cowboy still have so much impact for people who saw it when it first came out or since then? It's goes back to 1969, but it could almost have been made today.
It's pretty incredible, because for me as a New Yorker, and I'm, you know, we're hoping folks, you know, are interested and come up from New York City and then in the area as well, because it is in Socrates, the screening, and it's at Orpheum Theater. And we are also, you know, really excited about doing these other kinds of events that aren't just for the festival, and, you know, feel really blessed to be able to show your film. I know it showed at IFC Center and some other places. And so, you know, it's thrilling to be able to have this conversation. But to me, it feels very connected to New York City. Me, you know, myself, I lived there for 15 years. And so I think almost every New Yorker, even if you're not a film buff, have probably seen that movie, because it's just, it's that kind of quintessential New York. Like it's a film that is like a documentary, in my opinion. It's almost so real that it's not even like it's scripted.
There was a script, and a very tight script. And though there were a couple of scenes that were improvised, I would say that this is, in that sense, a conventional narrative. What was unusual was the way it was shot. Both John Schlesinger, who's a British filmmaker, had made many documentaries. He started off as a documentary filmmaker. He chose a cinematographer who also had a similar sensibility. They wanted to shoot on the streets. They wanted to shoot on location. They wanted to use available light wherever they could. They were taking a very documentary approach to the way the film looked. So I would not say that it was documentary in the sense that it was loosey-goosey and they just did whatever they want. No, there was a very definite script written by Waldo Salt. But the look and feel of it was very documentary-like. And I think that that's why people responded to it as strongly as they did, because they did feel like they were seeing something real.
It is rare to get that, especially at that time period. And then, as many people know, it won an Academy Award for being X-rated. Can you just share a little bit more about that and how that happened?
Yeah, well, that's a long story. We spend a lot of time in the film dealing with the climate at the time. This film explores a number of issues of gay life. And even though the two protagonists are not gay, it deals with a street hustler who's dealing with gay characters. And so there were a couple of scenes that exposed that more than has been seen normally. It's the first time that a mainstream film made by a proper studio dealt with some of those issues. And that was a period of time where a gay lifestyle was still considered a crime. And the only thing that was not criminal, if you were gay, you should be trying to make yourself not gay. You know, you were in therapy. You were trying to convert into a heterosexual lifestyle. And so there were physicians, there were psychiatrists that advised the producers that they would be safer if they actually took an X rating. So they would never be blamed for converting young people to a gay lifestyle, so that people would know what they were going to see ahead of time. And so it wasn't that the board that approved these films and gave the ratings decided it was X-rated. It was actually the producers who felt, and not because they believed it, but they were convinced by these psychiatrists that it would be the right thing to do. And so that's what they did. It didn't take long for people to realize that X-rating was probably not appropriate. There are really only two scenes in the film that could border on X-rated scenes. And so soon after the movie opened, they changed it to an R, and nothing in the movie had changed. But the rating changed just because people said, this is ridiculous. It's really not an X-rated movie.
So it actually did. It garnered it more attention because of that reason, which actually worked in their favor.
That's right.
Which is great. I kind of gravitate more to men that are more effeminate characters. He still had that masculine thing, but just the flavor, you know, his flavor. It was just, you know, that's how people are. And that just wasn't shown that way, where you can have a little bit of both. Like, you know, what's wrong with that? And even for that to be unacceptable is hilarious today, of course, you know, but then we're going through various sort of eye-opening experiences where, you know, things that aren't necessarily, you know, accepted are getting pushed into the mainstream more than ever, which I kind of feel like the 70s started that. Like a lot of just crazy stuff got pushed into the mainstream really suddenly. And so it's an exciting time, you know, for artists for sure. So I want to read your statements. I love your filmmaker statements. So you said today, as political and cultural wars paralyze the country, causing chaos in a city known for unrest, we face painful reminders of our 1960s past. We see lost souls left behind by the elite 1%. This is our real story. Midnight Cowboy is a tale of a city of broken dreams and strivers then and now. The film lives on not through its collapsing of social and cultural norms, but through our everlasting potential for love and salvation, offering grace to the most desperate. In Midnight Cowboy, one desperate soul tends to another out of compassion and their shared humanity. Only then do we know we are all savable. Everyone is worth love. Can you elaborate more on this?
I think that's why the film lasts. I think it's the compassion in the film and the connection between these two, Ratza Rizzo and Joe Buck, that has continued to stay with people. You know, there were other films that came out around the same time, Easy Rider being one of them, that dealt with counterculture. That one deals more with drugs. But, you know, very soon after, there were films in the early 70s, including Mean Streets, Taxi Driver in 76, a number of other films that come out and really do show us life at that time and the culture. This one has continued to resonate partly because it's not just about life at that time, but it's also about the compassion that we have for people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder. You know, it's reminding us that people who are desperate and who are desperately trying to save themselves also could use a help from those of us who are not so desperate. So, you know, it's told with some humor. It's told with a lot of feeling. The music is wonderful. I mean, it just, people who saw it, they felt their lives had changed. And I think it's what's in that statement, I think, really does characterize why they feel that way.
I wanted to get into the fact that you do direct, write, and produce most of your films. And I'm curious, what is it like wearing so many hats?
Well, first of all, let me just say again that I don't produce by myself. I could not do it without Susan Margolin and Simon Kilmurray and Claire Chandler. Those are three people who have been with me on, well, Simon came on this film, but Susan and Claire have been on other films. So I'm really indebted to them. In a documentary, the writing takes place initially in your head when you have to decide what that film is really about. And I'm quoting Sidney Lumet, who likes to say that you have to decide what a film is about from an emotional standpoint and not a plot standpoint. So I come to the film with that in mind. So everything I said in that director's statement for me is what this film is about. And then I try to think about how can I serve that goal? And that happens in the edit. After you've assembled, you've got a palette like a painter has of many, many colors. And you start mixing those colors together and you try to figure out how do I get this on the screen to represent that emotional message that I've just delivered in that statement. And that happens in a conversation with my editor. I'm in the edit every day. And we talk about every scene and we kind of let it unfurl, almost like in this film in particular, in a free associative way, because there are so many different themes. In other films of mine, they've been a little bit more narrative in structure with a beginning, middle, and end. They tell a story. And so I have I kind of have an overview of what I'm doing. In this film, it was a little less so. It was a little bit more like a kaleidoscope, bringing all sorts of things together and hoping that they can be woven together in a way that it'll make sense to an audience, but also not be didactic.
And I mean, going back to your question, you got inspired obviously by the film Midnight Cowboy, because it's an incredible, emotional, just deep, touching film. and that's what you're drawn to, and that's why it has that staying power. But how did you get involved in, like, how does it go from, okay, I found a book, to I'm going to turn this into a documentary?
That book was very helpful. This is Glenn Frankel's book called Shooting Midnight Cowboy, with an even longer title than my film.
I was going to say, I couldn't remember it. I didn't write it down.
But Glenn was very helpful in discussing the meaning of his book and what I might want to do with it. I take his book as a point of departure. And then I spent a lot of time just thinking about it, reading more about Midnight Cowboy, watching it again, thinking about what it's about for me, and what story I feel I can tell, what I want to tell, and what I feel like I should tell. And then that takes me to the interviews. And the interviews are really critical in this film, because every person who has been interviewed brings something very personal to this experience. Many of them were in the film. Many of them are, many of them are cultural critics that lived during that period. And so they all contribute to the writing of it. I've written, in a sense, when I'm interviewing them, I am very careful to put questions in front of them that will also serve my goal. You know, it doesn't mean that we're not going to go off on other tangents, and that can be wonderful. That's where, you know, the magic happens, when they start talking about something that I wasn't thinking about ahead of time. And then that works its way into the film. But so there is a process. And it's somewhat premeditated, but there has to be a flexibility as well. You really have to be open to what these people are saying and how they're responding to your questions.
Beautiful. I also, you know, just wanted to again plug the May 13th. I'm really excited. You're doing a Q&A with your producer. And, you know, these events are just amazing to be able to, again, interact with your audience. And this is outside of a film festival. And that's this weekend, May 13th. We have a lot of other events. And so I'm just really looking forward to it, because I know we're going to go over some of the exact same things. So I did want to talk briefly about the Loving Story. So the Loving Story, you know, I currently am married to a person of color, Afro-Caribbean person. And so, you know, it's a very interesting topic, but the film is essentially a documentary that is the definitive account of Loving versus Virginia, the landmark 1967 Supreme Court decision that legalized interracial marriage. And just not many people know about it. You know, it was not something that, you know, got any real love, not surprisingly. So I also wanted to ask you a similar question with this project, and it came out in 2012. How did you get involved in this particular project?
Well, that was my first film. And I had been running a documentary film festival for the previous 10 years, and I had been looking at lots and lots of documentaries. And I was at a point where I was really ready and wanted desperately to make a film myself. And on May 8th of, I think, 2008 or 9, I'm not sure, maybe off by 1 year, Mildred Loving died. And there was an obituary about her in the New York Times. And I just went for it. You know, I thought, how is it that no one, I had looked at enough documentaries to know that there wasn't a documentary about them. And that amazed me, because not only was it a critical film that dealt with interracial marriage, but it was also such a beautiful love story. And it just felt ready made for the screen. So I was kind of surprised it hadn't been made. And within a half an hour, there was one book that had been written on it. I had optioned that book. I literally called the author. I called her publisher. I called the author. I had made a deal like within an hour, and I knew that was going to be my film. So it was, these things are never easy, but as filmmaking goes, I think the connection that I had to that story and the way in which it unfurled was relatively seamless. And during the period while I was making the documentary, along with Elizabeth Haviland James, by the way, she was my partner on that film, I was in conversation, coincidentally, it's a long story how that happened, but in conversation with Colin Firth, and he was interested in the narrative version of it.
Wow, at the same time, and that came out in like 2016, Loving.
It was just a few years later. So I was pitching both the documentary and the feature film. And it was going to be hard enough to get the documentary made as a first-time filmmaker, but I figured the narrative would be even harder. But having Colin and his partner, Jed Dougherty, on that film helped us move it forward. And we were able to attract Jeff Nichols to it. And as you know, the rest was history. So I was a producer on that film. But it's one of those things where if you find a really good story, it can take many forms. You know, it should live as a documentary. It should live as a scripted film. You know, it could live as a podcast. You know, there are so many different formats for great stories. And it's all about finding the story many times.
I love that, because most people probably saw Loving, which is how it happened for me on HBO. I saw it has really good distribution and it's in a bunch of different places. And we'll get into that later. But I saw that first. And then, of course, immediately went to watch the Loving story. So, you know, and my husband watched it, and I definitely want to show it to my kids. And, you know, it's one of our moments where, you know, I think a lot of people who have mixed race or interracial, there's not a whole lot of conversation about that. It's, you know, much more accepted, but I can only imagine, you know, what we would have gone through at that time. It just would have been crazy, you know, and the story is just absolutely incredible. I mean, I cannot believe it. Like you said, it hadn't been made into a movie.
When I put together pitches, I did them simultaneously. Now, I didn't write the script. Jeff Nichols wrote the script.
Right.
But and I think he would be the first to say that he was inspired by many of the scenes in the Loving story. And those scenes, many of them are replicated in the scripted version.
He actually says that his inspiration is your film, you know, your name. Yeah. And it's really, it's nice. It's like, that's just not something you see very often. Not only is the story itself unseen, then there's this additional piece to it. It's just fascinating.
Yeah. Because this was my first film.
And that's incredible that this was your first film. Yeah. I mean, wow. Did you come out of the gate with a winner?
But honestly, I wasn't aware how rare it was for a scripted version of a documentary, first of all, to be made at all, but also to be as closely aligned with the documentary. So it seemed like, well, it makes sense. You know, the documentary is telling the real story, and Jeff believed in the truth. He believed in he wanted to capture the emotional resonance of the story, which I think we did in the documentary, but he had an opportunity to go further with that. And with the great performances by Ruth Negga and Joel Edgerton, I mean, hard to beat,
the
right?
Acting is incredible. So I just wanted to talk about everything's changing with distribution. Your films are in a, you know, bunch of different places. It's a big deal for indie filmmakers, right? And there's so many platforms and there's so many new ways that people are doing these distribution deals. I did a bit of research and there's some platform called Mubi that has all of your films, and it's just handpicked cinema. It's like a new film every day type of platform.
Well, first of all, I wasn't aware that Mubi had all.
Yeah, right. I figured.
Each film is different, and the time in which you make your film can really impact what kind of deal you make. We've gone through what we call a golden age of documentaries, and the last two films I made before this one, A Crime on the Bayou and The Rape of Recy Taylor, came out during that golden age. And so it wasn't that difficult to get distribution. We had some wonderful, you know, Shout Factory, Shout Studios, and The Orchard, both, they picked up those films. They got them onto Stars, and one of them's on Hulu as well. So, I'm not trying to make it sound easy, particularly in this current climate, which has changed enormously. And Stars is no longer buying documentaries. From what I understand, I don't want to be on the record.
It's hard to keep up with everything.
They're changing. CNN kind of shuttered their documentary unit. Showtime is buying very few documentaries. So whereas 2 or 3 years ago, there were more than enough buyers for these films, now they're very few. And there are many filmmakers that had films in last year's Tribeca and Sundance and even the year before that haven't sold their films. So we're no longer in a golden age of documentaries, I can tell you that. And I'm hoping that we will come out of this slump. But the fact that we do have distribution, Zeitgeist and Kino Lorber have come on to support Desperate Souls, Dark City, we're just immensely grateful, because it's a tight, tight market. And that we're going to be showing after the screening in Sovereignty's with the Woodstock Film Festival, we will be showing at Film Forum in June. And so we're just honored and grateful, because it hasn't been easy this year. You know, a few years ago, it was a different story.
It just changes so quickly. So tell us about where we can see some of your films. Like, For instance, the Loving story I already mentioned, and then Loving itself, like, how do you even keep track of, I mean, you said yourself, you didn't even know it was on this kind of new streaming platform, right? But like, you know, just for people who really want to go see your films, it's part of it is like, oh, I go look up this person, I was seeing this film, but then there's like 50 different, how do I even see it? It's just
Thing I do when I'm doing research and I'm looking for films, I just Google the film. And usually there's a category under Google that will say where you can see.
They have that now. That's lovely.
Right. Yeah. So you can check that out. But I can tell you that Loving and The Loving Story are on HBO Max, will eventually be Max, or very soon will be Max. Both the Afternoon of a Fawn, Tana Killer Claire, and By Sidney Lumet, those are two films that are a little bit more in the cultural category. They're both on Amazon. And then Rape of Rishi Taylor is on Stars and Hulu. Crime on the Bayou is on Stars. I don't know where Desperate Souls will be. We're just starting those conversations. And then you can usually find them on these other platforms where, you know, like iTunes, there are a number of other platforms you can find them on that are not subscription, they are rentals and purchase. So, but it's not usually too hard to find them.
It's true. I think it's just, it's kind of like a process, but now I realize Google has done that, which is really cool. Makes our lives a lot easier. Right. And I mean, how do you even keep track of all these different, it's wild. But I could see wherever Midnight Cowboy is, you know, your film being there too, because of course people that have never even, you know, heard of Midnight Cowboy might come across it, or it might be they watch Midnight Cowboy, who knows what order they would do it in, but I feel like they would have to go, and I would want to go and watch it again, cause I saw it about 10 years ago, you know, so I need to watch it again. And I, you know, a lot of people love the fact that you can see something scripted and then learn about how it was made and kind of dive into it a little bit more. So yeah, those may have to be on the same. Who knows how you can watch Midnight Cowboy? How did I even watch it?
Well, let me tell you that, first of all, Film Forum will be showing Midnight Cowboy.
At the same time.
At the same time. It won't be a double feature. At another time. TCM has shown Midnight Cowboy quite frequently.
Right.
Criterion has it. I think Amazon may have it as well. I think Midnight Cowboy travels around. It's such an important film. You know, it is. A lot of people have it.
Yeah, that's great. So I quickly wanted to, we're kind of wrapping it up here. It's been such an amazing conversation. I did want to know sort of, you know, the kind of typical question, what's next for you? Do you have projects coming down the pipeline? Do you tend to take breaks between projects? Do you have a good life work balance?
I have no life. I only have work, which I love, by the way. It is my life. So I am always happy to be exploring other projects while I'm finishing up this. And there are about three or four that are kind of on the front burner. It's a little too soon to talk about them, but in fact, we're hopefully doing a deal in the next few days. And so maybe when I'm at Sovereignty's, I'll be able to talk about it.
Great. So definitely show up for that so we can know what's coming down the pipe. Yeah. Love your films. If you were to write a screenplay, or would you ever write a narrative piece, even though you do mostly documentaries?
I have actually written a script for a narrative version of Afternoon of a Fawn. And I don't know if that will get made. I mean, we're talking to financiers. There are a number of people who are interested in it, but we have not gone far enough to say that it is definitely going to go into production. But the script is written. So when we're at festivals and when we're doing this kind of conversation, maybe people will be interested in it, particularly if they've seen Afternoon of a Fawn. And that was an American Masters film. That was a co-production with American Masters. And it was on American Masters for a number of years. But now I think it's on Amazon. And I really encourage people to look at that because
Can you tell us a little bit more of what's it about?
Well, it's a story about Tana Killer Claire, who is an amazing, mesmerizing dancer in the late 40s and early 50s. She was actually married to George Balanchine and was also quite close with Jerry Robbins. But at the height of her career in 1957, while traveling through Europe, she's stricken with polio. And she almost dies. She's paralyzed from the waist down, and she never dances again. So she really has to reinvent herself and discover her identity in a way that has nothing to do with her body. So it touches on a lot of interesting themes that we are talking more about today than when I made the film, which has to do with the objectification of women's bodies and the kind of stress that dancers experience, but the beauty of dance, and it deals with the poetry of dance. So it also has to deal with a woman who was maybe the most poetic dancer I've ever seen, to find that poetry in her life after she can no longer dance. So it touches on a lot of themes, and I really encourage people to look at it. I'm very proud of that one.
So I do want to wrap this up with our final question. So the festival and your work is clearly all about being fiercely independent. And so can you tell us why that's important to you?
It has so much to do with people having a voice and being able to speak their mind and the truth and speak to justice, speak to power, and be independent. I think that's what connects all my films, actually. So I was glad you asked that question. I really do think that my films really are about people feeling empowered and having a voice. And I think that's what independent film is very often about, because we never know what's going to happen with our films. We never know how many people will see them. We'll never know. They're not backed by major studios. So if we don't have something to say, we're probably not going to make it. I would encourage people who feel that they have something to say to just get out there and make those movies. And festivals like the Woodstock Film Festival, I am sure they're going to be there to support you. I know you can't show every film that's been made, but they will be looking for films that have that voice.
Beautiful. Yes. Speak your truth. It's an incredible medium to be able to do that, to tell stories. And so just, can you tell us where we can find you on the interwebs or anywhere we can connect with you?
Well, every one of my films has a Facebook page and a Twitter account. And we also have a Instagram account, which is just called Augusta Films, which is the name of my company. But so each film, the name of the film is the Facebook page. I also have a personal page. So if someone wants to follow me, they can follow me on Facebook. And I basically share and, you know, repost and everything that on whatever on our film page, I share those as well. I guess that's the best way. Oh, we have, by the way, we do have, I should say, we also have a website, which is called AugustaFilms.com.
And that's your film production company. Yeah.
That's my film production. So it's AugustaFilms.com. And that highlights and gives you information about every one of these films and where people can find them.
That sounds like the place to go. So thanks again, Nancy. That's it for this episode of the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. Don't forget to please subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit the like button, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter @Woodstock Film Festival. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.